Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for the welcome and for getting us on the air. February is already here with lots of cold and lots of news. Gina, I'm really glad you can be with us because the lead story will be Aaron Lehman of the Iowa Farmers Union telling us about the confirmation hearing.
Tom Vilsack for Secretary of Agriculture.
I'm sure you'll have some questions about that. We'll also have Anthony Jones, Director of Equity for the Ames Community School District, describing Black Lives Matter Week from February 1st to 5th. That's a national week of action. It's not just a local initiative. And we'll close the show with some nostalgia about the anniversary of the tragedy that took place on February 3rd, 1959, in a field near Clear Lake. Paul Wearson will be here with us for that because he has some personal memories.
As usual, a variety of show lies before us. So let's get started by welcoming Aaron Lehman. Hello, Aaron. We're sure happy you could come by to give us your perspective on the Senate hearing for President Biden's nomination of Tom Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture.
It's good to be here, Gina. Thank you.
Yeah, it sounded like an obvious choice to many people, I suppose. As President Obama's Secretary of Agriculture, Vilsack certainly knew the job and could get to work immediately. And yet the announcement of his nomination brought a firestorm of criticism from many directions. Sierra Club saw disaster in the forestry policies, and black farm organizations decried the lack of support by the Department of Agriculture for black farmers who lost 85% of their land during the Obama administration. And opponents of industrial agriculture called him Mr. Monsanto. So as president of the oldest national farm organization, the Iowa Farmers Union, how would you describe the job of Secretary of Agriculture?
Well, it's good to be here with you. I really appreciate this discussion, and we couldn't be doing it on a better today since the Ag Committee yesterday acted on Secretary Vilsack's nomination, approved it unanimously, and moved it to the entire Senate to consider. They did this even though the committees are still kind of in this limbo stage about who's in charge as far as which party, and they're kind of still stuck there. But both the chair from the Democrats and the chair from the Republicans wanted to move this process ahead, and the committee moved it forward. So we know Secretary Vilsack pretty well here in Iowa, right? So we've got a lot of experience from decades with Tom Vilsack. And so I think when we've talked about Secretary Vilsack here, we've got a wealth of knowledge about where he's coming from and what it means for the USDA moving forward in this next term.
Do you think he's going to bring a fresh approach to sustainable agriculture or Monsanto or?
Yeah, well, he's pledged that this is a new department and that he's not the old secretary. He's being considered to be the new secretary, not to be considered the old secretary. That's in his past. And to be honest, agriculture and the Department of Agriculture have changed tremendously in the past 4 years. The past 4 years have really been a disaster up and down the line, the food chain.
A disaster.
So, yes. And so there's a lot to tackle. And agriculture has changed in that time too. And so there are a whole lot of new issues to tackle. So I think the best indication of where we think we're headed with Secretary Vilsack comes from what the Biden administration has already done. And, you know, the Biden administration has been issuing executive orders on a number of different issues. The ones that don't necessarily get the headlines are all the things that he's doing regarding agriculture. And I don't think any of those executive orders would be done if it wasn't a clear signal that what Secretary Vilsack hopes to do.
So, what are some of those executive orders that have been gone through?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. For most directly related to farmers, immediately, is that he signed a debt relief executive order. So borrowers from the USDA loan programs will get they'll suspend debt collections and foreclosures. Farmers have been experiencing years of low farm income due to trade and renewable fuel policies and consolidation in the industry. So this is about 10% of all borrowers, farmer borrowers from USDA will get debt relief and as far as stopping collections and foreclosures. So debt relief was a big one. Probably the one that got the most attention was climate, right? We're rejoining the Paris Accord in climate. And this will help us put farmers in the lead on innovating around climate change issues rather than trying to catch up with the rest of the world on trying to deal with climate change. You can't deal with climate change unless you work with farmers. And for years, and these past 4 years in particular, farmers were told by the USDA, when you hear climate change, farmers should only expect higher taxation and higher regulation and expect to be victims of those things. And this is a pretty clear change that the Biden administration wants to tackle climate issues and wants to put farmers at the lead of solving climate issues in ways that are good for farmers, climate smart farming techniques. So that was another one. The first one, debt relief. Second one, climate. Third is immigration. You know, we in agriculture, we depend a lot on workers that have been in limbo for way too long. So the immigration executive order puts us on a path to deal with too many workers have been put in limbo, and agriculture certainly depends on these folks. And then the last one I'll bring up, the fourth one, is food insecurity. USDA has a huge nutrition role, and the past 4 years, that role has just been given no consideration at all. And the reality is that a lot of our folks now are food insecure as we deal with the pandemic. From past recessions, the Great Recession, about 12 years ago, when President Obama first came into office, food insecurity went way up, and it stayed up long after the rest of the economy recovered. Food insecurity issues were really hard to address, and they lingered with us for years. The executive order dealing with food insecurity meant that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, is opened up and unburdened from the ridiculous restrictions placed on it from the Trump administration. So those four things are really good indicators about where we expect USDA to go under Tom Vilsack.
And so if you were having a conversation with Tom Vilsack, what are some suggestions you'd like him to put into place for agriculture?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and we in Iowa have had lots of conversations with Tom Vilsack over the years, right? So, but first, let's put it in context a little bit. You know, way back before he ever entered office, he was a small town lawyer from Mount Pleasant. He worked with a lot of farmers who were in one of the worst debt situations in their lives. And he helped a lot of farmers through saving their farms, avoiding the foreclosure process back during the farm crisis. Then we worked with him in the state Senate when he served there, and he helped defend our corporate farming laws. And then with during his term as governor here. So all sorts of things there. And one of the things that we will emphasize with him is, you know, the local food system was kickstarted through a food policy council that he set up as governor. It was abandoned after his administration, but a lot of very good things came from that. So we have a long relationship with Secretary Vilsack. If I had a conversation with him now, I would say it's going to be harder this time around. We've been through four very, very difficult years up and down the food system. And we have climate issues to address. We have a safety net that failed us the past 4 years. That needs to be addressed. We need to deal with revitalizing our local and regional food system, and we need to deal with the concentration in agriculture. Farmers just do not get their fair share of the food dollar. It's at an all-time low. So every dollar we spend on food in this country, what comes back to the farmer is now less than 15 cents. And that's just because there's a bottleneck there. Mm-hmm. So I would say that those are some of the main issues that we need to address right away.
And you think with all of his experience, do you think he's going to pull through with that?
This is the advantage that we have with Tom Vilsack being the person chosen for this position, is that he knows the department better than anyone else, and he knows these issues probably better than anyone else. The first time he was in office, the Farmers Union would often come to him about issues that would be far-ranging. Sometimes they'd be on farm programs, safety net programs, sometimes crop insurance, sometimes nutrition, sometimes. And the thing that was always impressive with Secretary Vilsack is that he knew the ins and outs of the entire department. He didn't just delegate things to a whole department, a whole sections to someone else. He had a very in-depth knowledge of the entire department. So the advantage of having him there now is that he doesn't have to relearn the ins and outs of the department. He doesn't have to relearn these issues. He can get started right away. And I think that's why we saw these executive orders come out right away. So I think that we'll hit the ground running with Secretary Vilsack when his nomination comes to the floor. And I think the area where that it will be most important is probably on climate, because I'm hearing that making some real progress in the first 2 years of the administration is climate, and having agriculture play a leading role in climate. So I think that's one area where we can see a lot of optimism.
I've heard a lot of conversation with concentration of agriculture. I mean, even some articles in some of the Farm Bureau newspapers and some of the other agriculture press releases sounds like there might be a lot more conversation too to have on both sides of the aisle with this concentration. What do you think they should do with this concentration to break it down?
Yeah, so there are a couple things that I think we need to do. One is that we'll need to work very closely with the Justice Department to start prosecuting cases on concentration in agriculture as seriously as we've worked on some antitrust cases in other parts of our economy. So in addition to that, there are farmer protections that need to be put in place for farmers who have contracts and for farm workers, because it's just an unlevel playing field. When one or two or three players control the entire sector of processing or the entire sector of inputs, it's just an unfair playing field. And workers and farmers at the one end of that system simply have to have some protections in place when it comes to dealing with issues of fair contracts, fair working conditions, and that type of thing.
Do you think they'll go back to enforcing the Packers and Stockyards regulations that are already in place?
I think we're going to see some progress there. That has to be at the top of the list, is enforcing the things that are already on the books. And of course, agriculture has changed a lot since that time. And we're contemplating issues that the previous laws might have even conceived of. So there will need to be some updating as well. But yes, enforcing what we have on the books is the place where we get started.
And so as far as climate change, what are some of your ideas as far as what agriculture is going to be led to do? Because, I mean, a lot of the press news is about how agriculture is one of the biggest leaders with cattle's, you know, doing their methane and contributions and all the chemicals in our foods and all those sorts of things. What do you think some of the policies that are going to get put into place or might be helpful to put into place?
Yeah, so we really think there needs to be a structure in place that farmers can get rewarded for doing climate smart farming. You know, there's a lot of farmers doing some very good things regarding climate, and those might include cover crops and diverse rotations and putting cattle and other livestock on the ground. Those are systems that help our climate. And farmers need to have a mechanism in place so that they can be rewarded for them, and making sure that those benefits get down to the farmers and actually help the farmers in their bottom line will be essential to make sure that climate smart farming efforts are worthwhile. If it's just tied up in red tape and a bureaucracy, and those benefits never reach the farmer, farmers are not going to enthusiastically embrace the efforts and be rewarded for them. So I think setting up a structure so that these benefits can reach the farmers is really going to be important.
Do you think it's going to take regulation or voluntary type of?
Well, I think across the whole climate change spectrum, it'll take both, right? You know, we know that that's going to, but as far as agriculture goes, I'd argue that we have a structure in place for voluntary conservation type programs that we haven't even utilized well. They're vastly underfunded. But farmers are familiar with the system of using incentive-based voluntary conservation programs, and we just haven't used them to the level we need to. So to me, that's the place to start. Mm-hmm. And if we don't take an active role in doing it that way, I think we're going to see a lot more pressure from society saying, hey, it's not happening. The volunteer efforts are not happening. Then there's going to be a lot more pressure from society to say, hey, we need actual tough regulations on farmers. That may come down the road. But I'd argue that we haven't even tried to really put together a solid effort to see how our incentive-based programs can actually work.
What do you think they should do or what could they do to incentivize young farmers getting into agriculture?
Yeah, we've got a long ways to go here. And the beginning farmer programs have a mixed record of success. There are some young farmer programs that have proved successful, but are we reaching the number of young people? And I think all of this goes back to a larger system question too. We right now have too much of our agricultural system, which is only available to young farmers if they have a large family or large resources to bring to the table to enter in. And a larger emphasis needs to be made for folks who want to get started in agriculture without having to break the bank in order to get started. And a lot of those opportunities, they may involve corn, soybeans, and our commodities, and we need to encourage that. But at the same time, a lot of opportunities in agriculture are for our food system farmers and our small to medium-sized farms that can make an income for a family without a 1,000-acre entry level. So we need to do a better job of making those opportunities real for people doing things outside of the commodity system, which takes just a tremendous amount of capital and resources. So by strengthening our local and regional food system, I think that's a good way to help beginning farmers.
So if you were talking to some young farmers that were just going to get into agriculture, what do you think some of the best markets as far as what should they, you know, if they're kind of an open slate, should I do Aryan berries or what do you think the next decade might be good for a market?
Yeah, I think you have to take a look at your individual situation and see how it might all fit in, what your passion is. You know, farmers of all different types are all driven by their passion. And so I would say that for young farmers, you have to say, these are the opportunities, these are the resources I have, this is the passion I have, and have serious conversations with your of course your own family and possible landlords, lenders, but what needs to happen is we need to have a serious commitment from USDA to say you're going to have whatever resources to explore opportunities for your farm. So I hope that's what the new administration will bring to the table as well.
Okay, we got time for one last question. What is it the Farmers Union actually does as far as a union and being involved in agriculture?
Yeah, so we've been around for over 100 years. We advocate for family farmers and sustainable agriculture. We work both at the State House here in Des Moines, in Iowa, and we work with legislators in Washington, D.C. as well, in the administration of various departments, advocating for farmers, because we all know that we can only be effective is if we work together well, and we in agriculture need to do that. So we've been fighting for family farmers and sustainable agriculture for over 100 years, and we're going to continue to do that moving ahead.
That's great. Well, we sure do appreciate your contribution today and sharing your information with us and being a part of the Farmers Union, leading your work and policy for all of our farmers.
Well, I appreciate the chance to have a good conversation. There's a lot going on right now, and it's a good time to have this conversation too. So thank you.
It's an exciting time with the new administration.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you so much.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where Susan Franzen and I, Gina McAndrews, have been your hosts for today. We just heard from Aaron Lehman, who's president of the Iowa Farmers Union, about yesterday's Senate hearing of Tom Vilsack being nominated for the Secretary of Agriculture.
Moving from national agricultural policy to AIM significant week-long conversations about interracial equity, we have Anthony Jones, Director of Equity for the Ames Community School District, describing Black Lives Matter Week, a national week of action, which takes place from February 1st to 5th. So here's Mr. Jones.
Our district made a commitment about approximately 4 years now. We made a commitment to equity and access that empowers all of our students to reach their full personal and educational potential. And it was a response to achievement data. We were not doing well academically, specifically for Black and Brown students in Ames. And so we began to engage in some professional learning. We began to look more intentional at our data, and we were able to clearly see that there were a lot of disparities in so many areas, specifically, though, with our Black and Brown students. And so this journey started about 4-5 years ago. So what you're seeing now is us being more intentional and embedding the work that we have been doing district-wide and learning how to make our district more welcoming for all of our students and all of our families, and looking at ways of how we can improve affirming all of our students in our district.
And so basically, though, you, in spite of the fact that you started 4 or 5 years ago, you haven't made much measurable progress. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. So we put some things in place. So, for instance, my position was added to the district. There was some restructuring at the district office, and so I serve currently as the director of equity. However, we also added equity coordinator at the district level as well to help support the work. What we're trying to do is to be more intentional again by having conversations, and what better time to have it than during Black History Month. And so we decided to adopt and engage in the Black Lives Matters at School Week of Action because, again, I believe that, when we look at the 13 guiding principles, when we look at the resources that have been provided specifically for schools, we believe that it aligned to the environment that we're trying to set at our school. And it's specifically recognizing and acknowledging that there are things that we need to change, whether how we respond in our discipline, how we engage in our curriculum practices, centering the lives of our Black and brown students so they can know historically not only the struggle, but also the joy of being Black in Iowa. And so I believe that these principles, these resources allow us to be more intentional.
And so what are some of the activities you're going to be doing during this week?
Yep. So, again, this is the Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. And so each day for this week is going to be set aside to have conversations and dialogue around the 13 guiding principles. So Monday, yesterday, we started off with restorative justice, empathy, and love and engagement. Tuesday, we engaged in conversations. Today, we'll be engaging in conversation around diversity and globalism. Wednesday, we're going to engage in conversations around queer affirming, trans affirming, and collective values. And Thursday, we're going to talk about intergenerational Black and Black families. And then Friday, we'll talk about being unapologetically Black, Black women in Black villages. And so those are the activities. So each of the lessons, they will either be a set-aside time where teachers will sit with their students and have conversations around these particular topics. Others depend on the comfort level and the age appropriateness. It's going to be embedded throughout the day, in, whether it's a math class or science class or social studies class or literacy class, these topics are going to be embedded within whatever those teachers are doing throughout the day.
Well, I should think that right now, on the national level, where you have white supremacy organizations making, of course, headlines, as well as a huge push for diversity. I mean, what you're seeing politically, I mean, I can see it in appointments, I can see it in advertisements, I can see it in everywhere. It's just hugely different than it was a year ago.
Right, right. And that's what, our students are seeing that too. And, what we know and what we realize is that our students are having these conversations already. So, when the bell rings or when they're changing classes or when they're out in the playground or they're sitting with each other during lunch, they're having these conversations about racism, about oppression, about differences and how to interact with each other. But then, when the bell rings and it's time for them to go back into class, it's more of like sterile, like learning and what, what I define as, well, not me, but, what it can be defined as more of a Eurocentric type of learning where, if you're going to learn about a scientist, typically it's going to be a white male. They're not going to learn about, female scientists. when they look at, you know, math and the different things and historically the different cultures that added value to, you know, the math problems that students are working on. Typically, it's going to come from a white narrative. So what we want to do is to broaden that line to let all of our students know that there are different cultures and races and ethnicities who have given to the learning that we are engaging in today. So we want to provide a more welcoming and a sense of belonging and inclusiveness, not only just saying that we're diverse, but also meaning it in our everyday actions as educators.
So when it's not Black Lives Matter Week, what are you doing?
Yeah, so usually, you know, this is Black History Month. So in the past, you know, some schools don't really celebrate it, like in a way where, you know, it's a national celebration, but you typically don't see too many, like, recognitions or acknowledgments during Black History Month outside of Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King, or Roosevelt Park, or George Washington Carver, you know, because we're in Ames, Iowa, of course, Jack Trice. And so what we are hoping that our teachers will continue is engage in these topics that the students learn. I'm quite sure students will ask more questions about those topics. And so we'll continue having conversations around Black History Month for the rest of February. We are still engaging in our critical consciousness equity professional learning. Right now, our instructional coaches and our coordinators at the district level spending some time in a book study around culturally relevant pedagogy and looking at ways that we can support our teachers in their classrooms to be able to support all students. And so, you know, this is what we've been doing again for the past 3 or 4 years, specifically a heavy dose of professional learning with our teachers. And so some of our teachers are, you know, way more experienced in this learning. Some are novice, just hired new teachers in the district. We have people who we hired new in different positions. So we are helping them enter into these conversations at the level that they're at. You know, we are moving them along in the district with the district that we're trying to create here. And so another thing that we're going to start doing is we're going to look at celebrating other races and ethnicities in our district that we haven't done in the past. You know, in October, there's the Latino Hispanic month that we really haven't celebrated in our district. We're going to be more intentional about acknowledging and affirming those families and students in our district and community. You know, there's indigenous people when we have our Columbus Day, right? It's usually has always been called Princess Columbus Day, but now you can even see in the calendar now, you know, we call it, refer to it as Indigenous Day. And so we want to recognize our indigenous people and the land that we walk on here in the state of Iowa. We want to be more intentional about acknowledging specifically those who have been historically marginalized in our culture.
Sounds like a tall order.
Yes. And so, you know, that's the exciting part of the work. You know, I used to say, you know, I used to work at the middle school. I was an assistant principal there for 5.5 years. And, you know, I really loved, you know, when the bell rings, standing in the hallway and greeting students and interacting with them, you know, during lunchtime when, you know, they're engaging. And you see so much excitement when they're in the hallways. You see so much excitement when they're, you know, in the cafeteria engaging with each other. And, you know, you see so much excitement when the bell rings and it's time to go home and they're getting on the bus and they're having conversations. But I've also seen the other side, that many times when our students enter to class, it's kind of like they enter into a spaceship, into another world, and get off onto another planet, and it's just kind of like sterile. And I've always made this joke, our students come in, it's almost like life is sucked out of them. And so when they enter into a classroom, and so we want to change that narrative. You know, as I said before, our students have been engaging in these conversations. They really led us in terms of meeting on their own. You know, it was a group by the name of Sacre at a high school, students advocating for race and ethnicity. in their schools in racial justice, and they were meeting during their win time or plus in every Friday, and they would have a conversation around, you know, racism and sexism and homophobia. And I remember visiting and seeing, you know, just the energy level and the advocacy and the support that students had for one another. And we want to bring those things in the classroom. Our students shouldn't have to wait till the bell rings or, you know, it's time to go home for them to have conversations about what they're seeing every day, whether they're watching TV or whether they're on social media. They know that these things are happening, and we want to be able to engage them and draw them in into the learning experience in the classroom. The educators that created these, you know, these resources, the 13 Guiding Principles, I thought it was so wise of them, one, to start it at the beginning of Black History Month, because what it symbolizes, one, is that oftentimes, you know, Black people in their culture are presented in like one homogeneous type of way. And, you know, this allows for, you know, our students to know that, you know, Black people intersect at different, you know, areas, you know. So, you know, it's not just about race, but it's also about culture. It's not just about race and culture, but it's also about, you know, how to interact with, you know, gender roles. And so that's one thing that I appreciate about, you know, it started at the beginning of Black History Month. But then the second thing is that when you look at the principles, it begins with empathy and love and engagement and, you know, restorative justice, you know. So not how to just respond with punishment, but also to restore those who have been harmed. And so these principles, you know, what we're trying to do is embed it in our culture to create a sense of belonging. And I love the fact that the first day yesterday started off with conversations around empathy and love and engagement. And so what better way to start any conversation around that? So hopefully, you know, us being more intentional by having these conversations, that it would go into the classroom and then it would spill over into the hallway and then spill over into the playground. And so we're being able to see more of that empathy and love and engagement with our students, and then our teachers with our students, and our teachers with our administrators, and our administrators with our teachers, so on and so forth, that we create that sense of belonging in our school district. So that's my hope.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I will enjoy talking with you next week about how it came out.
Also next week, we'll be continuing the celebration of Black History Month with a discussion with Rochelle Chase, telling us what she learned as she wrote two books about the racially integrated coal town of Buxton in southwest Iowa, which flourished from 1900 to 1920. Also for Black History, tune in to Local Talk tomorrow, when we have an archived program about the Martin House in Ames, a very important boarding house for Black male students at ISU in the first half of the 20th century. You'll learn from it how its tradition lives on. This is KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts today have been Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen. Today is February 3rd. The 52nd anniversary of the tragic accidents that took place on a snowy night in a cornfield near the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. In case you don't remember it, and we do have some people in our studio who do remember it, here's a broadcast made shortly after the event.
Historian from Clear Lake, Iowa, three of the nation's top rock and roll singing stars, Richie Valens, J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson, and Buddy Holly, died today with their pilot in the crash of a chartered plane.
Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper are dead. These three young men were on the road to highly successful careers, and now they're dead, and I don't know how to respond to that.
It was so hard to believe that those guys were dead.
They've talked to people that said they heard where I was killed in it.
Mr. Carol Anderson, the manager of the Surf Ballroom, was called out to that plane crash site to identify the bodies.
I couldn't believe what I saw. Richie Valens and Buddy Holly were the two closest to the plane, and the Big Bopper went beyond the fence about 30 rows of corn. It was a pretty gruesome picture. Richie Valens lost half of his head.
It was just like somebody turning the lights out. Everything just stopped.
That'll be the day when I die. Will you give me all your love and eternal?
It seems strange to call Buddy Holly, who died at the age of 22, the father of rock. But in his brief time in the spotlight, he created the defining sound of the 50s.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yeah, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love. So here I go, breaking all of the rules. It seems so easy,
seems so easy, seems so easy.
Oh, so doggone easy,
doggone easy, doggone easy.
It seems so easy,
seems so easy, seems so easy, seems so easy.
Well, you're concerned, my heart has turned. It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love.
Paul Brisson, are you joining us? I know you must have been playing some of that music when you were DJ at Luther College, right?
Very right, Susan. Well, of course, you know, today is my birthday, I should say that. In fact, this tragedy occurred when I was just turning 16, 62 years ago. Now, I'm at the age where when you put candles on the birthday cake, it requires some real planning. And I play my birthday pretty low key because I really hope that St. Peter has misplaced my file and I'm not going to be summoned home. But when I look back on the tragedy, I remember hearing that. We had a malt shop up here in Story City. And, oh, it was a true tragedy for all the teenagers, you know. And it was a remarkable event because, number one, we have to look back on that rock era as a time when the industry was so small. At Decorah, Iowa, where I went to Luther College, I was program director of the radio station. And it has an interesting history as a station because we had one of the first broadcast licenses in Iowa. And Luther College owned the transmitter, and we were on the air a limited number of times during the week, and then KDEC was the commercial station up there. In fact, we had to use their studio because ours on the campus burned down, and that's how I happened to be at KDEC studio when Kennedy was shot right in the middle of my newscast. The teletype went wild. Anyway, at the radio station up there, it was a mom-and-pop operation, and there was a DJ there, Winky, and we did hops together back in those days, and just to let you know how small the rock industry was, Decorah, Iowa was in the northeast corner of the state, and Daryl Winky could go to the Paul Brown Booking Agency in Chicago and book the top acts they were probably traveling from Chicago to Minneapolis, and so in the summertime, when we'd have our record hops, we could get the top people. I remember we had Terry Stafford. He was the number one hit at that time during the summer, and he was right there on the stage at Modder's Ballroom in Decorah. And, you know, I've had the experience of standing next to a teen idol when all the kids are coming at you, like a stampede. And we had Bobby Vinton and Bobby V and Bobby Goldsboro. And at Luther, I worked with Peter, Paul, and Mary and people like that. So everything was smaller then, and the industry was just. But the only people we couldn't get were Elvis Presley and the Beatles, you know. And so this was the accident you're talking about. What happened in Clear Lake? I presaged that by several years. I was at Luther from 61 to 65. And this occurred in 1959, so it was kind of nearer the birth of rock music as a popular entity on the radio and on the, in the media. And you had Ritchie Valens, who was a Hispanic singer out of Los Angeles. He was, I think, still a teenager. He only had that one hit, La Bamba. And then you had the Big Bopper, who had Chantilly Lace and a pretty face. And then, of course, Buddy Holly, who's seen as sort of a seminal figure in rock history, Day by Day. It was just a real tragedy because, number one, there was a winter party. They call it the Winter Party Tour. And they were touring all over the Midwest, and these were pretty well-known stars at that time. And they, it was like my experience at Luther, where you could get the top people at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. And in fact, I was up at the Surf Ballroom just a few weeks ago when our football team went up to play Clear Lake. And, you know, you really have to follow the signs to follow the Surf Ballroom or find it. I always thought it was on a major highway, but it's sort of tucked in an industrial area in Clear Lake. And you really have to follow the signs. But anyone in Clear Lake will tell you that people from all over the world come to the February dance party because of the fame of not only those three entertainers, but also the seminal moment it was. Of course, you know the song, The Day the Music Died, was written in tribute to the death of those three people. And so basically, it was just a tragedy that grew out of a problem. They were traveling in a bus. And when I was at Luther, when we did the summer hops at Decorah, it was a station wagon and a U-Haul trailer, and the current number one artist might be traveling that way from Chicago to Minneapolis, and they stop in Decorah for a one-night stand with us. Well, we might have 2,000 teenagers at that record hop, you know. So I'm trying to impress everybody with the fact that the industry was so much smaller. People were so much more available. And so the card at the dance party on February 2nd in 1959 was big name stars right there in Clear Lake. And the problem was that they were traveling in a bus, a very modest bus, you know, just a regular bus, and the heater broke down. And so that's when those three guys decided to book an aircraft to get to the next stop, which I forget where that was. It could have been in South Dakota or Minnesota. Anyway, they were going to hop ahead and avoid the cold bus trip. And they booked a plane, and the pilot was a man named Roger Peterson, who was very young and not a very experienced pilot. And so they crashed almost on takeoff, and it was beginning to snow, and it was bad weather, just an ill-advised thing to do. But they put Clear Lake on the map internationally forever because that was the day the music died. And, of course, the drama of that among teenagers was teenagers feel things so personally and so dramatically that the death of three people at once who were budding rock stars was deeply shocking. And that's why it's been institutionalized as the day the music died, a time in rock history and music history. And when you look back on it, it was the seminal moment in rock and roll as an idiom, both on TV and radio and, of course, the record industry. How many plays you got on radio stations determined your success.
As we close out this tribute to the rock musicians killed on February 3rd, 1959, let's play Ritchie Valens' biggest hit, the Spanish language La Bamba.
Arriba y arriba, por mi cerebro, mi cerebro.
have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Gina McAndrews and Susan Frangin have been your hosts for today. Remember that you can also hear today's show online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests are not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were Aaron Lehman, Anthony Jones, and Paul Wearson. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD,
The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Other music you heard was That'll Be the Day and It's So Easy to Fall in Love by Buddy Holly and
La Bamba
by Richie Valens.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. You can just get on the website and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.